Hello, beautiful people. My guest today is Peter Jennings, and Peter is an entrepreneur and the creator of Fantasy Labs and Lucky Trader. Fantasy Labs is an analytics platform that helps players with daily fantasy sports, and Lucky Trader will hope to do the same thing for NFTs. If you've been following me and following my journey, you know how into NFTs I really am. And so in this conversation, we spoke about NFTs. We also spoke about how Peter was seated next to Mark Cuban and Tiger Woods and how crazy that is. And more broadly, we talked about how to evaluate when you should take asymmetric bets, what is play to earn, how Fantasy Labs started, and where he sees the world going in 2031. Overall, incredible episode. I learned a lot. Peter is a really interesting guy who takes a really thoughtful approach to everything he tackles in life. And for that, I am extremely grateful because we got to hear some of his wisdom in this episode. I hope you enjoyed as much as I enjoyed recording it. If you have any thoughts, at me on Twitter, at HeyDannyMiranda, and it would mean the absolute world to me if you shared this with someone you think would enjoy it. So, without further ado, let's get into this episode with Peter Jennings.
Interesting people, thought-provoking conversations, nutrition for your brain. Journey through the minds of the world's top performers and discover what it really takes to achieve your highest version. This is the Danny Miranda Podcast.
Peter Jennings, the man, the myth, the legend. Thank you for coming on the podcast. Really appreciate you taking your time.
Oh, I'm stoked. I love the podcast. I've listened to a variety of episodes, including from good friend Jonathan Bale, so stoked to be here.
Yeah, well, Jonathan spoke very highly of you, and you know what I talked to Bales about was the incredibly fortunate position you got with placing next to Mark Cuban and Tiger Woods. So I figured we'd get it from your perspective. What happened there, and how did that go down?
Yeah, that's for sure the luckiest moment of my life. So right after I had another lucky moment winning that DraftKings Millionaire Maker. So I was riding high and went out to Tiger's charity event. I played the poker tournament, which all went to charity. It was a $10,000 buy-in. I believe at the time I put up half the buy-in and DraftKings, because I was a brand ambassador, put up the other half. And it was a random drawing, and I drew the seat next to Tiger and Mark, which was just a surreal experience. And yeah, it's great talking with Tiger about DFS golf and just all of his experiences. But the big win there was chatting business and basketball with Mark, and we became fast friends, and been fortunate to be aligned with Mark on a variety of things since then.
Was that a dream come true? Like, did you appreciate that moment for what it was? Did it live up to the expectations you had for it in your head?
I feel like most times you have higher expectations than like the reality of the moment, and that like far exceeded even my expectations at the time. I mean, it was just absolutely unbelievable. We were, you know, partying with those guys, super fun, and like everyone of course was coming up to us. I was getting a lot of publicity for the DraftKings win, so it was just, yeah, it couldn't have been a better situation where I was built up in front of like two people that I idolized. So it was an awesome experience. And so many cool things happened from there as well. So it's just, yeah, that was definitely, I tell people that was the luckiest moment in my entire life.
So I'd love to go to your origin story and how this all began. Were you always interested in betting as a young kid? Were you always interested in numbers and analytics? Like, what was the signs that you would go into the fields that you have gone into?
Yeah, I think it definitely was the case. I mean, I love sports growing up. That was always a huge passion of mine. I love competing. And actually my biggest strength was math. I won like some math competitions in elementary school. I was really good at just like quick math. And I've always just been interested in numbers. I started investing in mutual funds when I was 9 years old. I was the kid who was, you know, buying and selling things all the time. Actually, the most trouble I got in elementary school was for trading and selling Pokemon cards. I traded like a bunch of like common Pokemon cards for a Chansey holo, and the mom got really mad and I almost got suspended. So always been into the risk reward game. Certainly as a younger kid, maybe I pushed it too far and trying to take advantage of certain situations. But yeah, those were kind of early signs, I guess. And yeah, I was really fortunate to find online poker kind of at the right time. I was a little later than some, but that was a really good kind of intro into all of this stuff. I played online poker for a living throughout college, was fortunate to build a bankroll, and then Black Friday happened. So I had to pivot. I ended up being a stockbroker for a little over a year. During that time, I was playing on FanDuel, and once FanDuel became big enough, it was very clear to me that there was an opportunity to not only play and make money, but I was really excited about the DFS industry. So I quit my job and pursued DFS full time, and there's a ton of stories along the way, but I've been very lucky and fortunate to know good people and just have some good outcomes since then.
With the Pokemon cards, have you held on to any of those?
I wish, man. I had like a first edition Charizard. I had all sorts of holos, and I sold them for poker money or something like that. I don't even know when I don't remember exactly when I sold them, but I was substantially older, but I definitely didn't sell them at like a top time, especially relative to where we are now.
Yeah, so it seems like collectibles and trying to figure out the best way to collect and sell and trade has always been in your blood, and that leads me to the perfect opening about NFTs. When you saw NFTs, were you like, this is immediately me? Or were you like, this is crazy? What was your initial reaction to seeing NFTs for the first time?
Yeah, great question. It was kind of a mixture of a lot of things. I was really interested in crypto. I've been involved in crypto for a long time just because of betting and things of that nature. So I was fortunate to be exposed to it early. So I've always been interested in any crypto projects. So that part was exciting. I've actually not been like a huge collectible guy. The Pokemon card is an example where I was, but I wasn't into like, I mean, I collected sports cards as a young kid, but I, you know, before I found NFTs, I wasn't into like traditional sports cards, and I didn't have like a big art or any collectible collection. But NFTs clicked with me a lot more just because of the digital element. And then, of course, my favorite concept's always been the sports stock market concept. And as soon as I found Top Shot, I figured that could be kind of an intro into that sports stock market, and ultimately maybe could be a sports stock market. So it clicked for me, and then, you know, Bale started writing about it, and I started to see just a little bit of the fervor, and dove in head first. And I guess that's just the nature of kind of being a risk reward guy, is I thought there was an asymmetric return relative to the risk that we were taking.
How do you evaluate a new opportunity and say, this is an asymmetric opportunity right here? What things go on in your head? What questions do you ask, and how do you make that determination?
I wish there was a better science. I definitely felt really crazy. I remember when I first started getting into this stuff, it's like, wow, I just spent, you know, $10,000 on this NBA highlight, and now I'm really into CryptoPunks. I remember looking at those, and I'm like, at least I'm not that stupid guy buying those. And boy, I was a stupid guy not buying those. So lessons learned. But yeah, you start thinking about just kind of the future. And I think the best way to look at these opportunities and to find asymmetric returns is to think about things from a probabilistic standpoint. Instead of thinking, will this happen or won't it happen? Start, you know, kind of going through the ranges of outcomes. And yeah, with NFTs, to me, it clearly was something that's going to be a big part of the future. And obviously, we're still early days and there's going to be a lot of pain in the future. But I do see a lot of really cool things coming from this. And, you know, there's a 10% chance that they're going to be massive, massive, massive collectibles down the road in huge parts of the history. At least that was my thinking at the time. Now I think it's substantially higher, obviously. But I started kind of just weighing the different ranges of outcomes, and relative to the prices that things were back then, I thought it made a lot of sense to make the investment. So thinking about like how likely something is to happen, I think is a much better way versus like the black and white of yes, no, which I think people have a tendency to think about when they're looking at investments.
How do you know exactly when you've lost your edge?
Whew. It's hard not to be results oriented. it really is hard to not be results oriented. I think a lot of people, including myself, you know, you start to lose at something, you start to lose for a consistent period of time. It's easy to kind of give up at that point and think you've lost your edge. But I've had sustained losing streaks during my best years in DFS and sports betting. So it's tricky, but I think you really have to look at things objectively, depending on the markets that you're looking at. But one thing too is just like, how early days are you? You know, for me, I know I'm not the smartest guy in the room, not even close. So a lot of times when there's opportunity and alpha out there, it's early days, and I try to identify those early days. And that's, I think, part of where I can find alpha. So as markets mature, oftentimes you're going to have less edge. But sometimes you might be able to have edge in more mature markets, especially if you surround yourself with really smart people. So yeah, it's a tough thing. I don't know. I don't have a great answer, because I think I've tended to be a little too results oriented, which I think is the mistake that most people make. But taking a step back and trying to look at things objectively is the best way to try to determine if you have an edge. And I think from a macro standpoint, identifying where you are in like the cycle of a you know, market is also a big thing. Because yeah, maybe you're someone who can come to a more mature market and thrive on that and build sophisticated algorithms, or you know, have some other alpha that's not just identifying an opportunity. For me personally, it's more about identifying the rising tides.
So it sounds like you try to find a market that's in its early stages, like you did with DraftKings and daily fantasy early on. Now you're doing it similar with NFTs. And at what point do you say to yourself, okay, this market is more mature? How can we evaluate that? Let's say we're talking about NFTs now specifically. How do we evaluate when it's a more mature market?
Well, it's interesting. I think NFTs in particular, right now, we're in this weird state where I think we're super early days, which is a cliche thing to say, but I think we're going to see a ton of new NFTs, and just digital ownership itself, I think, is something that's been revolutionary with crypto. Markets that trade 24/7, 365 is something that I think will be applied to almost every asset class in the world. And in a lot of ways, you know, we haven't seen a lot of the main ideas that I love for NFTs. Like, I have a huge sneakerhead, this evidence behind me. I love the concept of Nike having, you know, maybe a Nike app NFT to get access to sneakers early, or, you know, the restaurant idea that people are throwing out there that I think Gary Vee just did. Like, imagine you could get access to a 3-Michelin-star restaurant by owning an NFT, and only, you know, NFT holders can enter. The cool concept of Denver Beer Company doing beers for life, which is something super intriguing to me. I think a lot of these companies and brands are going to issue NFTs that have real value. So we're in the early days where it's mostly been art, collectibles. I'm also really bullish on play to earn. So in that way, we're super early. But in terms of prices, especially on the current NFTs, I think we're you know, in that euphoria phase where there's some crazy, crazy prices out there, and that's clearly not sustainable. So it's interesting. It's hard to kind of balance something that I'm really bullish on long-term from just a technology perspective and how it's going to evolve versus where we are in terms of prices on the current existing NFT. So I'd say right now we're very mature and in a weird state from a euphoria perspective on some of the pricing of NFTs, but we're such early days on like the market itself, and there's going to be tons of opportunities. And I think the thing I'm most excited about, at least in the short term, are some of those company examples I gave, and then also play to earn.
Yeah, can you break down and explain exactly what play to earn is for people who might not be familiar?
Yeah, so I think the best example right now is Axie Infinity. Basically, there's NFTs within these games, and the NFTs accrue value, and you can use the NFTs to make money. So that's been a huge thing for Axie Infinity. There's a couple other projects that are coming out today in particular. A lot of people are talking about these goons, which I've gone into. Disclaimer, I'm not trying to pump those bags. It's just I'm investing in them because I'm really interested in play to earn. And we'll see. I think the key right now, like Axie, I think has been a wild success. But to me, the really successful games are going to be games that people love to play, regardless of the making money. And then the play to earn part on top of it is really cool. So like probably the best example of a game is Fortnite, which has done, you know, a tremendous job building its brand. And obviously is a huge business that, you know, just a tremendous amount of people play. And I think they've done billions and billions of dollars of in-app purchases, but that's all in a closed ecosystem that the developers control. So to me, imagine you had that same type of game that people love, And if the, you know, things within the game, people could sell 24/7, 365 in an open marketplace, that would be really cool. So I think we'll see more and more of this as things evolve. And there's a couple NFT projects that are in that play to earn mold that I think are really worth following.
You mentioned, you know, listen, this is what I'm investing in. I don't want to shill this investment. I don't want to tell people what to buy. How do you, you've put out content now for a long time and put out content on Daily Fantasy for a long time. How do you toe that line between being objective and also getting people information that you think is valuable?
Yeah, great question. So I definitely haven't done this perfectly. I think in general, I've just followed my passions and, you know, I was obsessed with DFS, and people even asked me during the early days, like, why are you, you know, giving out information when you're playing? You're like diluting your edge. And I was aware of that at the time. And I do think I hurt my edge in terms of just making money from playing DFS, especially in the early days. But at the same time, I was able to build businesses on top of that, help DraftKings grow. And yeah, it's always kind of a trade-off there. So to me, there is a lot of extra value in like building up the DFS ecosystem. And I genuinely like really wanted to do that, and I had a true passion for it. Of course, I wanted to make money in all aspects, but my number one goal was to like build the game because I was so passionate about it. So I always felt good just giving out as much as I could. And of course, you're going to be a little bit biased, and you know, I could have done certain things a little bit better. But for the most part, I was really passionate about it. For a stretch of time, I thought I was pretty dang good at DFS, and I tried to explain my thought process and how I went after things. With NFTs and like other assets and whatnot, it's a little bit trickier. I'm still trying to figure out how to optimally do that. I think Michael Levy does an exceptional job of that. He just recently wrote something on MLB Champions. He's done a great job with that with Top Shot. So trying to emulate other people, I think, is that you think do it well is a really good approach. And yeah, it's tough because you get into certain things and it's really fun to pump stuff up, and you know, you go into different chats and you're on Twitter, and it's fun to pump things. But at the same time, you want to be objective. And I know people, you know, follow some of the things that I say potentially, and I certainly don't want to be misleading. And especially right now, things are so frothy. It's you know, you always want people to be careful and make smart decisions. And it's another cliche saying, but people should absolutely be doing their own research.
You mentioned that there were a couple of things you could have done better looking back on the days of DFS when you were the DraftKings ambassador. Is there anything that stands out that you could share with us?
Yeah, I think I would have been more selective about like when I did content. There's definitely stretches of times when I did too much content. And there's absolutely days where I was much more focused on playing and you know, probably suffered from the content. So I would have done less, but tried to do when I did content extremely well. And of course, you know, you had to grow the game, so there's a need for like consistent content. And that was the beautiful thing about DFS, was that there's new content that was pertinent every single day because there's new slates and things starting every day. But I do think I probably diluted some of the quality by the amount of volume that I was doing for a stretch of time. And then in addition to that, I did some content with people that maybe I wasn't 100% sure of. And one thing I would have gone back and done a little differently is just like really made sure I was doing content with people I thought were great. And just like, and not that most of the people I did content with, I was thrilled with, like Adam and Al and the Rotogrinders guys. And of course, super proud of what we built at Fantasy Labs. But I would have been a little more selective. You know, for a while, I said yes to everything. And I think if I just would have been a little more conscious about the volume and the quality and the people I was working with, that would have been a better decision.
You know, you mentioned there's a 22 or 23 year old right now who wants to put out content in DFS or NFTs, and those are obviously different things. But what route would you suggest that person go down? They have no connections, but they just want to put out content. What is the advice that you're telling that person?
One, I think the best thing you can do is find the content that you love and figure out why you love it and try to emulate people that are successful and that are doing a good job. I think that's always good advice. And basically any industry, that's one amazing thing about kind of the world we are in right now, is there's so much content and so many niche things that you can find someone that loves what you love that's probably doing a really good job. There's a obviously the bigger industries, you're going to find a lot of bad stuff too, but I think it's good to emulate people you're drawn to, and to see, you know, a lot of times you can see which people are most successful as well. And sometimes there's bad actors that are successful too, and you have to identify why they're bad actors. But for the most part, if you emulate the successful people in whatever you're trying to do, that's a good thing. Two, definitely just get out there. I think a lot of people end up not doing things because they want to be perfect. So they get, you know, paralyzed by just, hey, I don't want to get into this because I don't, you know, they do want to do it, but at the same time, they're like, I got to do it perfectly. And then they end up just stalling and not moving forward. I'm sure you have friends like that. I have tons of people in my life that always talk about doing something and never take action. And I think a lot of people generally get paralyzed by, you know, the fear of putting themselves out there. So the main thing I think with that lesson is just get out there and do stuff. And then three, it kind of goes along with like the emulating successful people, but like try to make good relationships. And then I think a lot of people, when they're trying to get out there and make those relationships, they go to the people that they see that are successful and they ask them for things. And instead of asking people for like help or anything like that, figure out how you can go out and help someone. And I think that was probably the smartest thing I did with Mark. And I was fortunate to have some good mentors and just understanding from being in DFS, like, you know, most people when they meet Mark Cuban, they pitch him on an idea and say, hey, give me money. I was hanging out and talking with Mark, and it's like, how can I help you? And, you know, we're talking basketball, and I was sending him some business ideas. And our relationship actually started by him sending me a lot of pitches that he sees. So that's one thing I think is really a good thing to do if you're trying to break into an industry or move up, is like find the people who are the most successful and figure out ways that you can help them.
Why didn't you pitch Mark Cuban initially? Because that would be the initial inclination. But what told you, you know, I just want to provide value, I just want to help him in whatever way I can? Obviously, that's your natural inclination. But why? Why do you think that is?
I mean, a lot of what I just said, I think it's so important to help other people. And, you know, putting yourself, you know, in Mark's shoes, like think about Mark's life. His life is getting pitched all day. So if you're giving him a hard sell, like you're just like everyone else. I imagine it's much more unique for a young kid to, you know, try to help him. And, you know, we are just also trying to be normal. Like we're talking basketball, cracking jokes. And the last thing I wanted to do is like make the table awkward by selling. And I think that's something else. Like the best salesmen and the people who are good at telling stories and like delivering and creating value, they have pretty good awareness normally of when and when not to do things. Like the worst thing you can do is sell at the wrong time. So just being normal, hanging out, talking about other things, especially in that context where, you know, people are partying a little bit, playing poker, it was the right time to just like try to build that relationship. And then even afterwards, I wasn't inclined to actually pitch him. I was just trying to help him. And actually, when I first told him about Fantasy Labs, I actually reached out for help. I didn't ask him to invest. I just said, hey, this was right when DFS had all those legal issues. And I said, hey, we have this great company. We're growing really fast. We have a big team. But now we have this uncertainty around regulation and this lawsuit that just came out of New York. Any advice? And he just responded, my advice is let me invest. And then he was the most helpful investor possible. So he's our only investor, but super helpful.
How did Fantasy Lab start? What's the origin story there?
So Jonathan Bales and I, we connected in 2012. It was right after I quit my job as a stockbroker. I was really fortunate to win the FanDuel Championship, the first six-figure prize in DFS. That was actually a bigger win. I would say it was a bigger win for me personally than even the million-dollar win. And that was right when I quit my job. I was young. So there was a lot of just confirmation that this is the right thing to pursue. So Bales reached out to me because he was writing books about DFS, and at that time I just won the big tournament, and some people connected us and we became fast friends, and we worked together on that book, and we just developed a really good bond and relationship. And after that DraftKings event, we had met in person, and both of us really wanted to build something together. And yeah, we initially built something else other than Fantasy Labs, or at least tried to build something else. And the mistake we made with that business is we outsourced developers, and that was clearly a mistake. That never really got off the ground. We didn't put a ton of time into it, but we quickly realized that we needed to find like really good engineers. And fortunately, Dan Fabrizio from Sports Insights reached out and said, hey, we'd love to work with you. And they had already built this great site. And the two developers that had built that were going to come on as co-founders. So that was a kind of the perfect team, perfect mix of talents and experience to build something great. And luckily, things came together perfectly, and we were off to a kind of a great start. And yeah, DFS was growing, and it was just, it worked out really well. And it was, I wouldn't say it was easy, but we just had the perfect kind of synergies with the founding team to really scale that business quickly.
What makes for a good or a great team when working together?
Yeah, complementary skill sets. I mean, I think you have to be aligned on vision. I think culture is really important. Obviously, you always want to work with high quality people. And that's something that compounds better than anything else, is high quality, good people. Not just smart, but ethically, morally, kindness. I mean, all the things that, you know, are obvious, but I think a lot of times people are kind of jaded by just trying to make money. But surrounding yourself with people that you want to surround yourself with is critical. And then on top of that, you want all those things to be very similar. But then on the other side, you want to have, you know, complementary skill sets that are oftentimes very different. So I was more of the front-facing person for the company. Obviously, the DraftKings deal, people knew who Bales was. And then on the Sports Insight side, I mean, they didn't have the same notoriety or experience in DFS, but they, you know, Dan had all the sports betting knowledge. And then Kevin and Mike, our developers and ultimately, you know, co-founders as well, great people, and they're incredible developers. So they were able to build the things that we needed, so we could promote and get access to the community and industry that they didn't have access to, and they could build the things that we can build. So it was a kind of a perfect setup, and I think the best teams are kind of, you know, built that way. And actually, sorry for the mouse clicking, but I retweeted something today from Ray Dalio that I think is kind of similar to what you're asking. He said, you need people who share your taste and style, but can also push and challenge each other. The best teams, whether in music and sports or in business, do all those things at the same time. So, and then the quote is, play jazz with people with whom you're compatible, but who will also challenge you. So complementary skill sets, like-minded in terms of like culture and who you are as people, but then also guys that will push you and get the best out of you. Because the worst thing that can happen with teams is you just have a bunch of yes people who just say, oh yeah, you're doing great. You need to challenge each other. And I think the best teams do that.
Was there a sense in the early days of Fantasy Labs that, oh, we're building something here that's really going to work, that's revolutionary, that is going to change the game? Or was it just like, we're going to take one step at a time without really sensing a greater vision past 3 years or further down the line?
Yeah, I mean, Fantasy Labs was a really big blessing in that we knew we had something great, like, pretty much immediately. At the time, basically, everyone was doing the same thing. They were just doing content. Almost everyone who was doing DFS content was just giving out picks, some doing better than others. But we saw a huge need for tools and data. And, fortunately, we worked with, you know, that team, and they had all this historical betting information, which I thought was really relevant. And we built tools that no one had ever seen before. And as soon as we launched, I mean, I got hundreds of messages, people looking to invest, people signed up immediately. And basically the company was a success as soon as we went live. So it was just kind of the perfect moment in time with the perfect team. And not every business is like that. We were really, really lucky that things came together so perfectly. But it was just the right time in the industry to build something different. And that's another thing in business I think a lot of people make the mistake of. And we're seeing it now with NFTs. How many new avatar projects are out every single day? People are just copying other successful projects. And I think at DFS at that time, most people were just putting out different versions of like content picks. And instead of doing that, we built technology and we built tools that were innovative and different. So anytime you can provide value with something that's different than what everyone else is doing, it's normally a win.
Yeah, I remember playing fantasy sports, daily fantasy in college, looking at Fantasy Labs and being like, oh, this is amazing. This is, if I played every day or this was something that I did as a profession, I would purchase this in a second. So it was kind of like that intuitive from the user's perspective of, oh, this is obviously something I need. And it sounds like a lot of people had that same insight when they came across it for the first time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we were just at the right place at the right time. And also at that time, the other really nice thing is there, you know, that was earlier days. It was at a time when DFS was much more inefficient. So you know, a good amount of people were able to make real money playing DFS. And, you know, if you were playing DFS full time, you absolutely needed Fantasy Labs. And so we built a big subscriber base quickly, which was really fortunate, but also just, you know, being at the right place at the right time.
So let's take those learnings. What learnings did you take from building Fantasy Labs that you're now using to build Lucky Trader? Because I assume there was some parallels that you saw that said, oh, our existing model or existing people that we have would work well with this new paradigm shift in culture. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And I think we made a pretty big mistake early on, which is correlated with what you just asked, but also there's some really big positives. So on the positive side, of course, after Bales wrote that article, you know, a lot of people got into this. There's a high crossover between people who are playing DFS and sports betting and NFTs. You have people who are comfortable with risk reward, people who are comfortable in spending / investing money online. So there's a, you know, high crossover, and it made a lot of sense that that community got really involved in this. And that was obviously a huge, really beneficial thing to us to start the company. So we knew we had a community and audience that was hungry for these things. Our mistake, though, was trying to do exactly what we did at Fantasy Labs, not thinking about the big picture. And there actually are some pretty big differences. Our initial plan with Lucky Trader was basically to build a Bloomberg, but for Top Shot, and to, you know, basically make money the same way through subscription and build a business out that way. And for a variety of reasons, we pivoted. But I think one, you know, in this industry, unlike DFS, there's a ton of people who are great at building things. There's a bunch of engineers that are naturally interested in crypto. There's a bunch of builders in crypto. So where we had a big unique advantage in DFS for having, you know, great engineers and building technology, it's not as much of an advantage in NFTs. So that's one. Two, we saw competition come up really quickly, except for the exact reasons I just mentioned. And they were basically offering a similar product, but for free. Which I think is smart, actually, the more I've thought about it and kind of why we've pivoted. So we had these, you know, challenges like, oh, our original plan is actually probably not going to work. There's really good competition, and our competition is basically providing the service and product that we planned on providing for free. So we had to pivot, and now I'm really excited about our vision, which is much more top of the funnel and an onboarding process for all these different assets. And I actually think within NFTs, there's a huge opportunity for a great business that doesn't charge subscription, because the users in this community are so valuable. I mean, they spend a bunch of money online. We're in like on this new wave. We're on the ground floor of this amazing technology. And there's going to be tons of ways you can monetize this audience as the industry grows. So it's a much different approach than what we did initially, where we were just saying, hey, we're focusing on the hardcore DFS players. There's a really good business here because we can charge them a subscription. It's good for everybody. It's a win-win because they're going to be able to make more money playing DFS. They're going to pay us a subscription, and we'll grow over time, and it's great. Whereas in this, I think the whole goal is to educate and onboard more and more people into this space. Because now, you know, you look at the main problem, and from my view is that, you know, it's an intimidating thing. A lot of people don't even know how to set up a MetaMask. A lot of people don't know which projects to invest in. You know, people don't even, there's just so many questions that people have. And I think there's a huge need for more education. And I actually think it's the opposite of DFS, where everyone kind of came in and did content. Everyone here is building tools. So I think we actually have a really big opportunity on the content side. So trying to work with smart people like yourself and other really good content creators. And that's going to be a big focus for us at Lucky Trader. It's just trying to do the best job we can with content and onboarding. Of course, we're still going to have tools and things of that nature, but it's a different approach. And a learning lesson from Fantasy Labs is we tried to emulate basically the same thing. And, you know, we quickly learned that we should pivot, and that's what we're doing now.
When figuring out how to pivot exactly, what factors went into that decision other than seeing people also doing the same thing that you're doing for free? Is there anything else that you noticed that said, okay, we have to go in a different direction?
Yeah, I think the other factor is that there's just a lot of cool things. I mean, I'm super bullish on Dapper Labs. You know, just as disclosure, I'm an investor there. I'm a huge fan of everything they're building and love Top Shot as a product. And I think they're just scratching the surface of what that's going to become. And obviously, Dapper Labs has got other projects, and I think the Flow blockchain is doing incredible things. So we want to absolutely support that ecosystem and build things, but it became very obvious that there's other projects that I'm really interested in. And I think for us, you know, this onboarding process is really cool. And there's so many projects and different things that I want to get into. I'm really passionate about DeFi, which is, you know, was the big topic last summer. And now everyone's so obsessed with NFTs that it's not getting the same amount of love. But I think there's an incredible amount of cool innovation going on in DeFi. So we want to educate and onboard people into that ecosystem. Even basic stuff like, you know, I hold Bitcoin or Ethereum or another crypto asset. There's places where you can go out and get interest on those assets. So educating people about those opportunities. And then down the road, there's, you know, a bunch of really cool stuff that's going on in what I deem modern finance, from robo-investing to fractional investment like on Rally Road, to, you know, these cool things like Masterworks, where you can buy fractions of like really high-end art. You can buy parts of farms now. I mean, I think the world's really going to change a lot. And I think a lot of these assets are going to trade 24/7, 365. So we want to be on the forefront of educating people on those things through content and tools, and then onboarding those people onto those different platforms. And even sneakers and like some of these other things, collectibles. There's to me, there's just a ton of opportunity and a really wide funnel for all these things, I think, fit really well into kind of this modern finance highway, which is our analogy for Lucky Trader. We want to be the highway for all these things with different on and off ramps, whether it be Zed or CryptoPunks or NBA Top Shot or, you know, BlockFi. We want to have all those on and off ramps onto this Lucky Trader highway.
So if you look at 2011 and you look at 2021, you have a way different way of living. You have people interacting much more quickly. You have Uber, you have the internet working at a way different speed in 2021 versus 2011. Where do you see in 2031, how is the world different from your perspective? And this will be fun to play back in 10 years.
Yeah, no pressure. Let's play it back. And also, you've been asking all the questions. I want to hear your answer on this one for sure. And I've wanted your answers in some of these, but they've been more personal questions. But I want to hear your answer here. So one thing I've been super bullish on for a really long time is autonomous driving. I've had some conversations. People thought I was crazy that I thought this was going to happen. I think for sure by 2031, almost all, I think when you get in a car, it's going to be almost exclusively autonomous driving. And that's a pretty quick turnaround, 10 years. But technology has this exponential benefit when they're building on top of each other, and it can compound really quickly. So I think that's one thing that will be quite a bit different, is getting into these autonomous vehicles. I think there's some really big challenges ahead with climate and water and food and all these things. So it'll be interesting to see the trends. I mean, we've seen stuff like vertical farming, we're seeing stuff on carbon capture. So that's one thing that I think is really going to evolve, and that's a scary thing, but also a tremendous opportunity to help change the world, is investing and thinking about how to help the climate and some of the challenges that we're going to face. So that's one kind of scary thing that I think is going to change, that is changing now, but will be even more profound in 2031. So we'll see a lot of companies, a lot of people trying to tackle that challenge. Space travel will probably be bigger and bigger. So that's something that I'm hopeful to do at some point in time in my life. I'll be curious to see where that is in 10 years. A scary thing, but also a really interesting thing that could be really good for society, but also has some challenges. Protein folding is getting really big, and we're making tons of progress there. So on the upside of that, imagine, you know, you're diagnosed with cancer, and we can go in and manipulate the genes and different things to help cure that cancer. That's really interesting to me. The scary side is, you know, we start doing that to little kids, and like you start manipulating, humans start to play God in some ways. Like, there's some consequences there, some unintended consequences that could be really scary. So I expect that to play out to a degree by 2031. I think they'll take some time. You know, you can talk about robots and kind of where those are going. That fits into the autonomous vehicle conversation. I think we'll see a ton of that. I think the metaverse is going to be absolutely pumping at that point in time. I'm bullish on augmented and virtual reality. So that'll be really cool, is how much time we're spending in these digital universes. That's something I expect in 10 years to be just banging. So those are a couple of my thoughts. I have tons of others, but what's your view, Danny? What do you see in 2031?
Oh man, I have so many questions about what you just said, but my view of where we're going to go in 2031, I mean, it's hard for me to imagine at our current rate that the US dollar will be the standard for the world. It's just hard to imagine based on the amount we're printing could happen, but I would assume that something more global would come about. Climate change, like you mentioned, is really scary. And, you know, someone mentioned on the timeline about how you have people making millions on JPEGs and you have the climate going crazy in California and fires next to each other. And that's just wild to think about right now. And if that plays out to a further extent in 2031, that's a scary outcome as well. Self-driving cars seemed like a given to me. I don't think I'll be teaching my children how to drive. I think I'll be the last generation that learns how to drive a car, which is weird to think about, but really important for the safety of people in general. But you mentioned something, vertical farming. What is vertical farming? I hadn't heard of that before.
Yeah, it's a pretty big industry, actually. It's really cool. It's basically imagine like the building and the farms actually just grow up. Like imagine a skyscraper. And it's not at that scale for the most part right now, but there are examples of that where basically the farms, instead of being horizontal, they're vertical and they all build on top of each other. And yeah, it makes a ton of sense. You can grow a tremendous amount of food in a smaller space in theory because you're going up vertically. And I think food shortages is like something that's not talked about enough right now. And I think it's highly correlated with the water crisis that people aren't talking about. That is a real issue. And vertical farming, you know, I've heard pros and cons. I'm not totally convinced it's like the ultimate solve for this, but it's certainly interesting. And I think how food and water, those challenges play out are going to be a big part of the next 10 years.
What is going on with water? I've heard you talk about water on previous podcasts, but I didn't know what exactly that was about.
Yeah, so it's a really scary thing. I mean, obviously, you know, the water is the most abundant resource on Earth, but the majority of it is salt water, and it's extremely expensive and requires a bunch of energy to, you know, turn salt water into drinking water. In addition, the water issue is playing out big time in like the Western United States, for example. We're in a huge drought, and like the Hoover Dam's at its lowest water level ever. The federal government for the first time declared like a water emergency with the Colorado River. There's tons of areas that are growing, including where I live here in Denver, that I think are going to face tremendous challenge with the amount of people there, you know, agriculture and all these different things that require a tremendous amount of water that is not there. And of course, there's, you know, additional complications and uncertainty with the climate and how that's going to impact things. So it's scary. And, you know, you have the opposite problem in certain places. I mean, we're seeing tons of flooding. Like, obviously, this hurricane was disastrous in Louisiana. I think we're going to see more issues around flooding, you know, and potentially, you know, some real challenges with like places like Miami down the road as well. And again, this, you know, the time frame for this is hard to predict. And human beings in general have a hard time understanding exponential growth, good and bad. And that's kind of my concern around water and food. And even, you know, the Big Short guy, that's his big thesis right now. He's investing a ton in food and water with kind of the same thought. And not that he's always right. He, you know, that big win in that movie, he's shorting Tesla and things like that right now, which I don't necessarily agree with. But it's interesting that people are out there with a somewhat similar thesis. And yeah, it's definitely a concern to me. So we'll see how it plays out. But yeah, the water stuff, especially in the Western United States, is a real issue. California has a lot of challenges. So we'll see. And then, of course, around the world, I mean, a lot of people don't have access to clean drinking water, which mutual friend Drew Dinkmeyer has done a great job raising awareness and money through Charity Water. And there's a huge need for stuff like that in Africa. And there's droughts and different water conditions around the world that are really pressing and urgent.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting because I often think about how not everyone in the world has internet access, but water access comes way before internet when you think about basic needs for human beings. So I really appreciate
the oxygen, being able to breathe, but like, luck, I mean, and yeah, that's another thing. Like, there's so much pollution, and I don't know. Yeah, some basic needs are threatened for certain parts of the population around the world.
Have you always been someone who took and has taken such a macro view of the world and the issues that surround our world, or is that something that you've come into and started to research over the past 5 years, or is it something you've always been interested in at a deep level?
Kind of a mixture of both. Definitely much more in the last 5 years, you know, having a family now, and then also when you're young, which is totally normal. It's just the you know, it's natural to think about surviving first. So when you're young, and obviously we're very fortunate to be born in the US, but like my first thought was like, how can I make enough money to survive? How can I make enough money to get on my own? Like, you're basically trying to like play this game to get more freedom, which that game for the most part is just making money in the United States. But we're super fortunate to be here, and like even being able to like play that game and like have the freedom is incredible. So more of my time and energy was really focused on that in like my early 20s, I would say. And then, you know, when you achieve financial freedom, you start thinking about other problems, and you start reading more. And of course, as you get older, you learn more. And I mean, I'm still so naive on so many different things that, yeah, I'm a very curious person by nature. And, you know, I think it's natural for human beings to like want to solve problems. And, you know, the first like major challenge, I guess, and again, fortunate, like some people have to think about their health right away. Like, imagine you have cancer or something else. Like, there's much more important things than money. It just, I guess for me, the initial thing that I was really focused on was creating freedom so that I didn't have to do something I didn't want to do. And now, yeah, trying to solve some of these really big problems, especially after having a baby, it's like, whew, the future generations, you start to worry, especially as a dad. So, yeah. And also, you know, I've lived this life that's been very selfish, you know, gambling for a living and then getting into all this stuff. Like, there's some things I'm proud of that I think have definitely helped, but like a lot of it has just been, you know, around making myself, creating freedom for myself and my family, which is also, you know, important too. But I'd love to have like a more meaningful impact and like make the world a better place than when I got here. So that's something I'm constantly thinking about. And the way I'm helping the most now is through investing in stuff like this. I'm really interested in investing in climate. So if anyone hears this podcast and has cool opportunities investing to make the world a better place, especially from an environmental standpoint, I'm all ears. Please hit me up. But yeah, I'd love to actually spend my time on this, especially after kind of just getting more and more into it. It's certainly a real important challenge that we need to tackle.
You mentioned that you're a new father or had a baby recently. So what, in your mind, are the most important elements in being a father and raising a child that you're proud of after 18 years when they're ready to go off on their own?
So I think especially early on, of course, you're like our daughter Gracie's 6 months old. Initially, you're just trying to keep her alive. Food, sleep. Obviously, they're more durable than you'd think babies are, but at the same time, like, you know, especially when they're really young, you have to worry about their necks. And even now, she's just kind of a potted plant. So that's the initial focus. And a lot of that's like the micro stuff. So like that takes up a lot of your time. Along those lines, for any future dads or any young dads out there, I guess if you're already a dad, you're probably in the same boat. Like, a lot of the role as a father is to be a good husband and support the wife because they have a much bigger burden. So I'm very fortunate that Ashley puts up with me, and she's an amazing mom. And yeah, I need to do as much as I can to support her. But once Gracie starts to grow and really evolve and start to think more about things outside of eating, sleeping, pooping, etc., you know, I think one thing that's kind of my number one virtue is kindness. I always want to treat people how I want to be treated. And I think in general, human beings live for love, and there's so much animosity out there. And if you're online a lot and just with COVID, I feel like there's more hate and just polarization and just conflict than ever before. Maybe that's just a bias, but I do feel that a lot more. So, you know, I want Gracie to be a really, really kind person. And that's something that's really important to me, is just always try to be kind, even in just small interactions. It just goes a long way. And if you spread love, I think good things happen from that. along those lines, want her to have great manners, want her to be curious. I want her to follow her passions. I think it's really important as a provider to make sure she has access to everything. So those are some of the basic things. And then, yeah, I mean, as she gets a lot older, definitely start thinking about how can you change the world to make it a better place. I think that's a really important thing to do. I'm eager to learn more. I'm a young dad and certainly have a lot to learn. And kind of like we were talking about before, emulating my friends who are dads that are doing a great job, or talking with other people who are, you know, parents or older kids, like learning from them, I think is really important. And of course, my own parents have been great in Gracie's life and in my life. So taking lessons from them are also really important.
How do you instill kindness? Because that was the first thing you mentioned.
I mean, I think it just starts with just like always trying to be really nice to people. Do small things. Like, I feel like when I was growing up, more people like held doors, please and thank you. Anytime you can do like a small gesture, like it sounds crazy, but like, you know, I like some of the stupid stuff. I love like buying a smoothie for the person behind me. I love hosting friends, or just any of the small stuff, like letting other people go in front of you, being aware of your surroundings. Like if you notice someone's like struggling with something, going to help them. And just in all your life, like you can tell there's a lot of people who are just thinking, okay, what's in it for me in every situation? And instead thinking, how can I make the person, you know, I'm talking to, you know, be happier? What kind of things can I do? Or even in business or just like friendship, like really thinking about that person's perspective and like how you can help them ultimately leads to a much more fulfilling life. You'll get a lot more by giving a lot more.
One thing that I get from you is a real sense of humbleness, particularly around luck. And you've said it a few times, I was so lucky for this situation. We got really lucky at Fantasy Labs. Luck you seem to use and speak about often. Where does that come from, as opposed to taking credit for any of the wins? Why do you lean on luck so often?
Well, we're lucky to be here. I mean, the thing about, for me personally, like how fortunate to be born into the U.S. at this time with great parents, no real health concerns, just very fortunate to be born in a great place. And a lot of those things compound to like lead to where you are. And yeah, I feel very, very blessed and fortunate. And yeah, luck is maybe a broad term that I overuse a little bit, but for the most part, I just have a lot of gratitude for kind of the blessings that I've had. And then, you know, you can use the word luck. Obviously, there's some skill. Like in the long term, it's way more skill, but in the short term, a lot of things playing out is luck. You know, like winning that tournament, you know, I think it was a 24-person tournament that I won for FanDuel. Maybe I was one of the top two or three players. So let's say instead of like 4.whatever%, I was like 6% to win. It's incredibly fortunate to win. So there's tons of examples where, you're just fortunate to be at the right place at the right time. I would say a skill that I have that I think has compounded by luck, which is like, I think you do create your own luck in a lot of ways, is oftentimes I'm pretty good at seeing things develop before they like become a big thing, like a couple years out. I'm not the best at saying, okay, in 10 years, this is going to happen. So your 2031 question was a little tricky for me, but oftentimes I can see stuff like a couple years out, which has kind of been why I've been in the right place at the right time with like poker and then DFS and sports betting and then, you know, NFTs. Maybe I was like 6 months early relative to most. And like, I guess that feels like years in the NFT land, but those are things that I think are, I would say if I had to like rank my top skills, I'd say that's definitely one of them. So then you combine that with just good people around you and what is truly a little bit of luck on certain things, like it all works out. And I think going back to the kindness thing, like Michael Levy is a perfect example. He reached out to me and was like so kind and generous with his time. And we both have learned so much from each other. You know, I'm super grateful for all his kindness and like, yeah, like you do those things and then ultimately like the right people like end up gravitating towards each other. And like you start doing that over and over again, you start having success. Those successes compound on each other. And then all of a sudden you have credibility in new industries or new things, which is probably part of the reason Michael reached out to me in the first place. And like that stuff has a tremendous compounding effect. And like, yeah, you end up getting luckier more often because of all those things. So yeah, compounding is an amazing thing. I know I've used that word a lot on this podcast, but it's something I think about a lot. Like all these small decisions over time lead to like who you are. And as you're presented new opportunities and different things in life, like your past plays a big part of that as well.
What do you think you would be doing if you were unlucky in your first few months in DFS and unlucky in that $150,000 win that, let's say, you lost? What do you think you'd be doing if DFS didn't work out?
Yeah, DFS didn't work out, I certainly probably would have been in finance for a longer period of time, and maybe I would have found something really cool. I always wanted to do something entrepreneurial. It certainly would have been a different path. I like to think that I'd still find some success in different areas. But yeah, that accelerated things in a massive, massive, massive way. So yeah, and that at the time, and I think one other good lesson I've talked a lot about, but it's so true, especially for any younger listeners, like when I quit my job at that time, it was the perfect time to quit because I had no real responsibilities. I didn't have any kids, I didn't have a wife. If I fell on my face for DFS, like I would have gone back and like, I mean, I could have sold beer like I was as a beer vendor before. I could have gotten another job. Like my downside was not high. So it was a great time to take a huge risk. Like right now, let's say I wasn't in this position. You know, if I found something I was really excited about and I didn't have the liquidity or like wherewithal to like really put my family at risk, it'd be much harder to like go all in on something. I'd have to, you know, take like a part-time approach to something, which is much, much more challenging. So, and that obviously keeps, you know, that's an exponential thing too for like your age. Like you can't take big risks when you're 55, 60 years old most of the time because you have kids or whatever else. And it's a lot easier to take big risks when you're young. So that's something that's really important. And I think anyone who's listening who's younger, like if you're thinking about taking a big risk, not all risks are the right ones, but oftentimes, you know, I love the quote, like with big risk often comes big reward. The best time to take those big risks are when you're young and don't have other people dependent on you.
Why do you think people are so unwilling often to take risks in their, let's say, 20s or in their youth? Even though it seems like, from my perspective, that that's the best time to actually be risky because, like you said, when you're older, you're going to have family and dependents and stuff like that.
I think people are just used to the status quo. People don't like change, and they get really, they analyze things from a micro perspective. So, oh, if I don't continue working, I'm losing out on $10,000 or $20,000 or whatever. Or maybe I have a bonus coming up, or, you know, I like the, you know, safety of this job. And even though this is my passion, I can do that later. I think a lot of people make decisions based on like factors that are, worth considering. But I think people overestimate, like, another way to look at it from a really high level is, you know, if you think about like the world, like there's labor and there's capital, and ultimately the where you're going to get the highest leverage on your time and all the stuff is if you can become capital and you can have your capital work for you. When you're young, you're trading in your labor oftentimes for capital. And I think people get so caught up in like those micro transactions and like the small amount. Like the way to really get a lot of bang for your buck on your labor is to do something that has a lot of risk, to bet on yourself, to like create equity. And that's a hard thing to do because you're giving up short-term capital most times to do it. And people don't like to, you know, give up short-term losses for long-term gain. So it's a combination of a lot of things, but I think like having a short-term mindset is the biggest reason most people are afraid to take on big risk.
And have you always had a long-term mindset?
I think so. I mean, I mean, what 9-year-old kid was buying mutual funds? I mean,
that's
most of my friends
point.
Were go out and spending their money on stuff. And yeah, I've always been obsessed with numbers, and like I was really into money even as like a young kid. So from like a financial perspective, for sure, I've always thought long-term. Maybe where I haven't thought enough long-term, and something I'm thinking a lot about now, and I certainly need to be better, is like my health. You know, it's easy when you're young because you feel great and like you have your health. Like investing in your health and doing all like eating well, working out, things of that nature aren't as fun as like, you know, eating the junk food and drinking a bunch of booze or whatever. But those short-term decisions compound in a negative way versus like the long-term decisions of like eating well and treating your body right. So I don't know. There's a bunch of those trade-offs that are interesting. And so, yeah, I think in some ways I think really well long-term, and then in other ways like I'm kind of go with the flow and like enjoy the moment too. So I don't know. I think for sure financially and like from a business perspective, with anything that I'm building or investing in, like I absolutely take the long view because I think that's, you know, I just, yeah, even with like stocks and stuff, like I'm a long buy and hold type of investor. But with other elements of my life, maybe I could do a better job of taking the long-term view.
That's really interesting. And I heard you on a different podcast probably a year ago or so. You were saying how you would like to do a prop bet with pull-ups with the host. And I was thinking to myself, yeah, I'd love to do a prop bet with this guy, but I think we'd have a different level of capital working for us in that prop bet. But
I'm all for prop bets, and it doesn't have to be crazy money, but yeah, maybe we can negotiate something offline. And there's a, like prop bets around like doing pull-ups or any physical activity are great things because you can't cheat yourself, and it's a great motivator to go out and get in better shape. And that's certainly something I'm always thinking about. I'm diligent with the gym. I'm just, my diet and drinking have been pretty poor this summer with all the golf and all these things I'm doing.
Well, there's always time to turn a new page, and I'm certainly grateful for your appearance on this podcast. Before we wrap it up, I'd like to ask a final parting closing question, which is for someone pursuing the highest version of themselves, whether that's physically, mentally, financially, whatever it may be, what lesson or what advice would you give that person?
A lot of what we just talked about, I think, is really applicable. I think taking the long-term view on those things is great. I love the idea of writing out goals and setting like really high aspirational goals as well. That's something I do probably every quarter or so. I write out things I'm looking to achieve. And that has a really, really powerful effect, especially if you put it somewhere that you constantly see it. That's a really good motivator to kind of achieve something great, and just being cognizant of what you're trying to achieve. And then, yeah, along those lines, I think focus is another key thing. It's hard to do everything well. It's easier, and not necessarily easier. It's more obtainable to like accomplish something great or to like achieve the best version of yourself in some capacity by focusing on one thing. I'll contradict that by saying I think as a foundation, like eating well, sleeping well, and exercising, like for me personally, and I know for most people, if you do those three things well, you're going to do all the other aspects of your life extremely well. So I guess to kind of put those together, eat, sleep, and exercise, and do those things really well, and then set some lofty goal and go after it. And don't set too many lofty goals outside of the eat, sleep, and exercise part of it.
I love that. That's such great advice. Thank you, Peter, for taking the time. Where can people connect with you and let you know how much they enjoyed this podcast?
No, Dan, you're the best. I've really enjoyed this podcast and just a huge fan of yours and all the things that you're doing. Yeah, on Twitter is probably the best way to reach out. I'm at CSUram88. My DMs are open, but I probably get to like 5% because I get a bunch of crap DMs too. So just mention me is probably a better way than the DMs, I would say. But so on Twitter, if you hit me up multiple times, I'll most likely see it, and I'll try to get back to you.
Awesome. And we'll put that link below to your Twitter. Thank you again, Peter, for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Danny.
Hope you enjoyed the episode with Peter. If you have any thoughts about this episode, let me know on Twitter at @HeyDannyMiranda. As always, it means the absolute world to me that you are still listening until this moment. Thank you, thank you, thank you from the bottom of my heart. And please, if you enjoyed it, share it with someone you think would enjoy it as well. That's all for me. Hope you have a wonderful rest of your day or night. And I will see you in the next one. Peace.